Barry Malik back for County National Bank, and Barry's here about once a month.
Yeah.
Good morning, right. Greg.
Morning. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. It's last time I saw you was, I think, May.
Yeah.
And so take the summer off.
Good summer.
Yeah, good summer. It's kind of a strange summer weather-wise. Started out so dry, and then when we hit about mid-June, it got really wet.
I take them one day at a time, Barry.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The warm weather's nice, but this fall weather's beautiful, yeah. So it's really, really nice to see fall and cooler days and sunshine the last few days. It's been beautiful. So we're here again to talk about financial planning and all things financial. And before we get into that, I wanted to give a brief update on where things are at this point in time at the end of September 2021. The Dow Jones Industrial year-to-date is up 15.28%. And for the last 12 months, 32.25%. S&P 500 for the year, up almost 20%, 19.86. And for the last 12 months, 39.26. So that's really, really good and above normal. But that's where we are at this point in time. And then if we make the comparison between value and growth stocks in the large cap, large company area, value's at 18.55% year-to-date, and the growth is 19.68%. Running pretty close neck and neck there, where for a number of years we had growth really far ahead value, now they're kind of more in balance and in line with one another. In the small cap area, the small companies, you see quite a difference, a disparity there. In small cap growth, only 6.37 year to date, whereas the value is 23.36. And that's really the one that's hitting on all cylinders and given the best return as far as investment management styles. So, going to jump right into a couple things. We had the Bright Walls this last week. So, CNB is quite a supporter and sponsor, being a community bank of all things local and community. Beautiful works of art. If you haven't had
a chance, sponsor the studio.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. All things bright and beautiful, right?
There you go. Yeah.
And then coming up here on October 16th, the Fall Fest Chili Classic, downtown Jackson, another great community activity and event. So don't forget those. And then also to remember our CNB stock, been doing very well, it's running about $43 right now.
Wow.
With the dividends that we pay,
very
close
good.
To 3% dividends. So a lot of local owners owning our bank. So we really appreciate that.
Have to check with my broker.
Yeah, yeah. So lastly here, getting into the core and the feature of the show today, I've got a guest with us, Steve Mikulski. And Steve is a local estate planning attorney, also does real estate and corporate law, but really has a specialty and a niche in the estate planning area, all things wills, trusts, powers of attorney, deeds, quit claim, ladybird deeds, all of that. So I want to welcome Steve to the program. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Barry. Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you, sir. Enjoy the opportunity being with these guys, even though I'm disappointed that I'm not able to be in the studio. I had to call in this morning, but still glad to be with you guys.
You're feeling well, right?
I'm fine.
Okay,
yes.
That's good.
I had to squeeze him in here because he's got a 10 o'clock appointment.
Oh, okay.
So I said, you know, we can do the radio or the telephone version. So that's what we're doing today. So I appreciate you being here, Steve, and working us into your schedule. So a few things that we wanted to talk about. Oh, and before we get into the subject matter, just wanted to ask you about some staff changes and increases there at your firm. I understand you've got a new associate attorney and a new paralegal. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're doing real well and trying to grow and keep up with client demand. So earlier this year, we hired a new local attorney, Patrick Batterson, who passed the bar in 2020 and is very enthusiastic about our practice areas and also a lifetime Jackson County resident and with a strong desire to stay here. And then we also hired this summer Amanda Smith, who is a paralegal, and both of them are just doing great and taking great care of our client for us.
Awesome. So a few things to discuss today, Steve. We see this quite a bit, and it comes to be top of mind, problems that people have with joint-owned property. And that seems to be a default for many people who don't get financial and legal counseling and advice. They figure, well, you know, I heard that just owning it in joint name is a good way to avoid probate, so that's the way they go. So I wanted to start out a discussion today regarding some of the pitfalls of having jointly held property, some of the not well-known problems that people run into that end up really biting them in the end, and unfortunately, there's not a lot you can do about it later on after someone passes away. So let's cover a few of those right now, and I came up with about four different pitfalls, but why don't you cover the ones that you're aware of, and we'll see how we compare.
All right. Well, you've got one more than me. I came up with three that I think are very critical, and you're right. It is people will think it's a great probate avoidance tool, and it is, but you don't necessarily see the unintended consequences. The three that I came up with that I think are most critical is a loss of control, a liability risk, and tax liabilities or tax risks. And we can probably go through those and touch on a little bit of all three of them. The one thing that, you know, when we do planning and we use other tools that's not joint titling of property, we want the owners, you know, to basically retain control and ownership, during their lifetime. We don't want them to have to go to a child and have them say, okay, I want to take out a new mortgage or I'm going to sell the property. Now I've got to get my son or daughter's permission to do that. That's loss of control. If you join ownership, everyone who has an equal ownership interest in that property has to sign in order to sell it or to give it away or to take out a mortgage or anything like that, which can become very problematic.
Just a question there, Steve. Is it different in Michigan when it comes to the understanding of joint, tenants in common, where that you can actually do something on your own or sell your portion of the joint interest? Does that exist in Michigan? Or
It does. So there's basically three types of three ways you can own property with more than one person. Husband and wife, they own it by tenants by the entireties. And then when you're not a married couple, you either own it as what's called tenants in common or joint tenants with rights of survivorship. But even in a situation where you take tenants in common, which is what you're talking about, Barry, where you'd have your own interest, you know, say a 50% interest, you still would have to have cooperation, you know, in order to get a mortgage, you'd have to have all owners sign.
Good point.
So even choosing a different type of how you hold ownership to that property really does not avoid the risk of loss of control. Any other questions or before I move on to some of the liability risks?
No, that was helpful, though. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. In terms of liability risks, you know, there's two big ones that I made note of here on my sheet that I'm looking at. One is general creditors. So, for example, if you put somebody on there who's a joint owner and they don't pay their bills, or they're in an automobile accident and they're sued, that's their property. So a creditor can attach to it, not only real estate, but think about bank accounts, you know, and somebody is sued and those bank accounts can be garnished, you know, by that creditor. The other big risk that a lot of people don't think about, even though it's a common trend in today's society, is divorce. So if you name a child and that child gets divorced, your property could be pulled into that divorce, that family law case.
Yeah, that's a good point. And people will put their children or their grandchildren on an account with them, often a financial account, and they don't think about that, unfortunately, about half of marriages end in divorce. What are you going to do at that point if that child or grandchild gets divorced? And then that property is brought into that divorce situation for a division. Unfortunate, but it happens.
Yeah, we also do a lot with business owners, and that's a huge risk with business owners is that, you know, then you're ultimately buying out your child's soon-to-be ex-spouse so that you don't want to necessarily be in business with them or, you know, and so you end up having to write a check. So it can become a very costly mistake, even though, again, it's a great probate avoidance tool, but some of these risks people just don't consider. Because I think for most lay people, you wouldn't think of all of these things. But you and I, you know, do a lot of this type of work, and we see these kind of things come across our desk all the time. So, you know, and I'll get into this more if you want, but there's a lot of real simple alternatives to that don't give a current interest to a child or someone else that would avoid these, would still avoid probate, but would avoid these risks.
And let's cover a few of those momentarily. Let's get through this list. And what's the third one? Is that tax?
It is. It's absolutely spot on. And so there's a whole lot of tax consequences. You know, for example, I'll have clients that'll say to me, well, why don't I just name my eldest child, as beneficiary on my retirement account? Well, if you do, and then they, with the idea that they'll share it with their siblings. And, you know, first of all, you know, a retirement account is going to be taxable. From an income tax standpoint, all of that money is going to be taxed to that one child. They're going to be hit with income tax.
Exactly.
In addition to that, you know, if they end up saying, you know, there's $100,000 or $50,000 they're giving to their siblings, there could be gift tax, you know, issues. You can give a spouse as much as you want, and there's no tax consequences. But when you give it to anyone else other than a spouse, there's a $15,000 annual exclusion amount. And if you give more than $15,000 in a calendar year, you have to file a gift tax return and possibly pay gift tax or borrow from your lifetime exemption.
And in addition to that, and I think mentioning the retirement plans and the beneficiary designations is key because people do that. The other thing that I was thinking of, and maybe you've already got this on your list, is when you make someone a joint owner, such as a spouse or a child, you're going to lose a step up in cost basis for capital gain tax, correct?
Absolutely. And so that doesn't, you know, with the retirement accounts, it's not an issue. But if you have a stock account or anything that's going to have some appreciation from the time you invested in it to the point, even a business interest, for example, if you have that and they've grown in value over time, you know, when someone inherits it at death, they get your date of death value versus what you initially invested. And that could be a huge tax savings. But when you use joint ownership, you basically get the same basis, if you will, as when they first made the investment. So, you know, you could end up costing your beneficiary or your joint owner, if you will, significant capital gains tax and lose the savings. Absolutely.
And just to bring that down to eye level from maybe a 30,000 foot level, what we're talking about here is when you buy something, a piece of property or any asset, price called a basis, is it appreciates and grows in value through the years. That appreciation over the basis is called capital gain. Well, that capital gain, according to the federal government, the IRS, is taxable. And what Steve's talking about here is when the family member dies, there's a bump up in that basis from the original low original value to the current value. So now when the spouse or the heir of some kind goes to sell that real estate or other asset, that cost basis is much smaller. It may even be a slight loss from the date of death. So you save a lot on taxes.
Yeah, and just you know, as an example, I always try to give some number figures. If your original purchase price is $50,000 and it's $100,000 when you die, with a joint ownership, that would be a $50,000 gain. Whereas if they inherit it and they get that bump up, it would be a zero gain because it would be the date of death value of $100,000. You sell it for $100,000, there's no gain. If you just want to plug in some numbers and think of it that way. So it's a little bit of a complex idea, and so I like to try to throw numbers out just to give an example.
Excellent. Well, quickly, we've got about 3 minutes here. Give a few of the ways that we can avoid this joint ownership problem. And then I do know that it was important for us to hit on the portability of the estate exemption or exclusion. So just go ahead with that.
Well, I think, you know, with bank accounts and retirement accounts, the financial accounts like that, instead of having them as joint owners, make them a beneficiary. Make all of your children, you know, that you want to inherit, don't expect a child to share. That's a good way. We use ladybird deeds with or without a trust for real estate. And again, it avoids probate, but you don't have these issues that you have with joint ownership. You know, I think that's the best way to handle it. And, you know, joint ownership, sometimes people think, oh, well, you also have the benefit of them being able to do things if I become incapacitated. Well, do a power of attorney instead, and you accomplish all of the goals that you want without any of these risks. So,
excellent. Good recap there. Quickly, portability. Since 2010, and then it became permanent after 2013, we gained the ability now to take our spouse's estate tax exemption, or some people call it the exclusion, which is currently at $11.7 million per individual. That's going to drop down and sunset in 2025 or at the end of 2025. What this allows someone to do then is to not lose that, correct?
It does, and you know, and I'm not sure, it may change sooner. There's a lot of talk, and you know, for many of our clients right now with an 11 plus million dollar exemption, it may not be a big deal. But if it drops down to 5 or 6 million, which is sort of what is being talked about in Washington, it could be a big deal. But one thing you have to know, and you should talk with your tax professional, but it's important to file an estate tax return, what's called a 706, even if there's not tax liability, just to preserve that, you know, so that if there is tax liability at the death of the second spouse, you can benefit from that. I had a situation recently where that was not done, and it was somebody who had farmland, and they didn't really think that much about it, but it was a significant amount, and there could be an estate tax issue now.
And along with that, I mean, people will think about, well, it's so high right now. It's slated to sunset in 2026 to go back to that pre-2017 level of 5,000 or 5 million, and then with adjustment for inflation, 6 million. But, you know, if that changes any time before that, or if a spouse dies any time before that, and then that lowering of the exemption goes into effect, that could make a huge difference, because if it does drop down in the next few years to 3 million, 5 million, whatever, it will affect a lot more people. And carrying that exemption over, that portability, could save a surviving spouse a lot of money.
Absolutely. And you know, there's people don't realize, like I said, someone recently had farmland, but you think about everything that you own is included in that calculation, including life insurance if you own it in your own name. And I know a lot of people say, well, you know, there's no tax on life insurance. Well, there's no income tax on it.
Correct.
But it could be included in your estate, and you might have to pay estate taxes on it if you have more than the exclusion or the exemption amount. So it's really important if someone dies to check into that, because as I said, I recently wanted to bring it up today, Barry, because I had someone who really had a bad result. They went to a lawyer, and no one talked to them about that, and they've got probably close to, you know, $17 million of assets, so they're going to have $5 million that's going to be taxable.
Ouch. Well, Steve, we're running up against the clock here. Thank you so much for your insight and expertise, and for spending some time with us this morning.
Thanks, Barry. Thanks, Greg. I appreciate it always. Enjoy being on your show.
If someone wants to get a hold of you, what's your number?
517-787-5151.
And for me, it's 517-768-0043.